WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. The HBO drama series The Sopranos just started its third season last Sunday. David Chase is the creator and executive producer of the show, a mafia story that's as much about stress as it is about violence. It follows Tony Soprano, a middle-aged mobster in suburban New Jersey who has constant difficulties ruling the mafia family he heads and relating to his own wife and two teenage children. His panic attacks have led him into therapy, although he doesn't really believe in its effectiveness. In this scene, it's late at night, and Tony is alone, getting plastered in the kitchen, when his daughter Meadow walks in.
Why are you sitting in the dark?
I don't know. Light the dark. Sit.
I gotta go online.
Oh, come on. Sit for a minute. Come on. So what's going on?
With what?
Whatever, I don't know. What's going on?
I just told you. The chat room. Is that it?
You know I love you, right, man?
Dad.
No, don't dad me. Come on. I want to know. Do you know that I love you?
Yes. I know that you love me.
Well, your mother doesn't think I love you enough.
Can you listen to her?
Everything I do, and everything I've done, and everything I will do, it's all for you and your buddy, you know that?
I think you should go to bed.
I mean, I tell people, you're like your mother, but you're all me. Nothing gets by you. And I know you think I'm a hypocrite.
I'm going to bed.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
Dad, why don't you go to bed?
No, I'm gonna finish my drink.
Okay. Can I?
Go ahead, baby.
Sometimes we're all hypocrites.
Good night, baby.
David Chase wrote and directed many episodes of The Sopranos. Terry spoke with him last summer.
It seems to me that The Sopranos started off with a little bit more comedy and that it's become just more tragic for the characters as time goes on.
I know. People have said that, and I didn't realize that. I don't see it that way. So it's
you don't
very
see
difficult.
It that way? Uh-huh.
I don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The last show, we did a sudden U-turn. If that's what people are talking about.
The last show of the second season.
Mm-hmm. The last show of the second season. In that, there was a plan. We had a plan for Tony's emotional growth or lack of growth throughout the first season. The idea carried over from the first season was, okay, based on what we seem to remember about therapy or know about therapy, if you compress it all, and of course it takes much longer than this, and it's... You get to a point, my parents did this, my parents did that, you're slamming your parents, the shrink is saying, oh, those parents you had, what do you expect? You can't be any better than you are. And you go through that, and then you get to a point where it's okay, so your parents were your parents, now what are you going to do? You know, as a shrink once said to me, what would you like to do? Should we have an auto da fe and burn the old lady at the stake? And she's your mother, what can you do about it? And so we got to that point in the show, and the second season was about Tony realizing that people kept saying to him he was his own worst enemy, that the seeds of his own destruction and his problems were internal, as they are with all of us, really. In the end, you're here and there's no excuses for who you are. The kind of a U-turn that we took rather suddenly was, as we were doing show 13, I suddenly, something in me kind of snapped and I got tired of some of the moralizing that some of the characters were doing. And I began to feel that Tony Soprano is a gangster, he is a mobster, end of story. And that's enough said about him as regards his quote-unquote internal development for now. And so in the end, the feeling that I got from the end, from the last show, was that, and I thought it was also necessary to remind the audience, this is a mobster. This is a gangster. You may think he's lovable. He's also a very, very scary man.
Let's hear a scene between Tony and his psychiatrist, Dr. Melfi. And this gets a little bit to what you're talking about. This conversation isn't about Tony's mother. It's about who Tony is and the kind of problems he's responsible for of his own volition in the work that he's doing and in the crimes that he's committing. So here's Tony with Dr. Melfi.
Do you know why a shark keeps moving?
They got to keep moving or they'll die. They can't breathe or something.
There's a psychological condition known as alixithymia, common in certain personalities. The individual craves almost ceaseless action, which enables them to avoid acknowledging the abhorrent things they do.
Abhorrent? What certain personalities?
Antisocial personalities.
My future brother-in-law. Ran over a guy. No reason. Guy's paralyzed. Has to piss into a cathode tube. What happens when these antisocial personalities aren't distracted from the horrible shit they do?
They have time to think about their behavior. How what they do affects other people. About feelings of emptiness and self-loathing haunting them since childhood. And they crash.
The scene from The Sopranos, my guest is the creator and executive producer of the series, David Chase. Where does that scene take us in the development of Tony?
Well, it was intended to be building toward some sort of conclusion or some kind of self-awareness on Tony's part, that he, that it's no longer, you can no longer blame your parents, your mother. You cannot go through your life or go through therapy just leaning on that crutch all the time. That after a while, it's you. The problem is you. It's strange. As you were playing that scene, I felt the scene with Melfi. I felt very sorry for Tony Soprano. I actually got choked up. I sort of heard it for the first time, because she's not only saying to him, "This is what you do to other people," but she's saying to him that underneath that there's this just little scared person who just hates himself. I felt compassion for the guy.
Well, you're so lucky to have found in James Gandolfini someone who has such an interesting face to watch, and his face is kind of mercurial. I mean, although I'm sure he's trying not to betray what he's thinking, you can see what he's thinking on his face. And sometimes he looks very weak and vulnerable, and sometimes he's incredibly cold-blooded looking. How did you find him?
Well,
oh, and let me ask you one thing, too, in terms of looking for him. You've cast at the center of the series someone who is a very charismatic actor, but he's not a leading man kind of looking actor. He's got a pot belly, receding hairline, pudgy face. It's not Al Pacino.
No. I always go for the actor. If the actor who came in to read for this part had been Cary Grant, and it had worked, I probably would have said, "Fine, let's do that." But we didn't. What really we were blessed enough to have happen is that James Gandolfini came through our door. And I honestly mean this. This is, you know, without Jim Gandolfini, there is no Sopranos. There's no Tony Soprano. He is so integral to, I think, a lot of the people always ask me, "What do you attribute? Why do people like this show so much? Why the furore?" And it's because of him. That's why the whole thing, I think, is so identifiable to so many people, because he just is so human. And people respond to him. Their hearts and their heads go out to him, despite the heinous things he's doing on screen.
There's something very average guy looking about him.
Oh, it's more than that. I don't think he is that average. I think he is a very, very sensitive, hypersensitive man. And I think he reflects his environment in a very, very rarefied way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he comes off as the regular Joe, you know. But I think what's going on there is you have a very, very extremely emotional person and sensitive person. And that's what Tony Soprano has become as a result of him.
Sopranos creator and executive producer David Chase, speaking with Terry Gross last year. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with an interview Terry Gross recorded last year with David Chase, the creator and the executive producer of the HBO series The Sopranos.
Writing The Sopranos for HBO means that you can say things and show things that you couldn't do on broadcast TV. So here's some of the things you've done that you wouldn't be able to do on broadcast TV. Using a lot of expletives in the dialogue. You show a couple having sex front to back with the guy holding a gun to the woman's head because the gun turns him on. Disposing of a body by putting it through a meat grinder, although you don't really see anything explicit during that scene. Tony has had food poisoning, and we hear all the sounds that he makes in the toilet. I've never quite heard that on TV. Let's start with the toilet. Why be that graphic with the sounds?
It just seemed real. It just felt that, I mean, I've had food poisoning, and that's the reality of it. And we do try to do things. We try to make things real as much as possible. The reason for doing the food poisoning, that was not an idle choice, like, oh, wouldn't it be funny to have Tony have food poisoning? That came out of a need that I felt, and I hope most of the writers agree with me. I think they did. I just didn't want, in other words, pussy's a rat. How's Tony going to find out? I really just didn't want to do some kind of procedural thing in which Tony gets some little clue, and then he sends somebody to find out, and then people are trying to get the case on him, and they're reporting back to him. And all that exposition, it bored me terribly. And I just wanted Tony to know on some kind of subconscious level. And the food poisoning, I guess you could say maybe the food poisoning was caused by, if you believe in the mind-body connection, by this overwhelming sense that he had that his friend had betrayed him. You could make that case, I suppose, that's where it came out, was in his stomach. That's where his body broke down. And out of that delirium came this feeling, this dream, that seemed to click very solidly for him, that in fact his friend had betrayed him. Of course, he then did go and get the information. He found Pussy's wire, but we didn't have a lot of people talking about it and trying to prove it or anything like that. And so once we made that decision, then we always just try to do realism. It was not the toilet sounds were not a desire to. I mean, they are funny, frankly. I laugh at that stuff, but it was not. That's not the reason we did it.
Now, therapy is so at the center of the series. You know, Tony is in therapy. Were you in therapy a lot? Did you?
And a lot, yes.
Was your mother a lot of the subject of conversation?
My mother was a fair amount of it, yes.
Yeah. You said that she was really a worrier, you know, and she was...
She was a big worrier.
Yeah. Was that contagious? Like, if she was worried that if you did something, you'd be hurt, did you worry that if you did it, you'd be hurt too? I mean, did it make you a more kind of cautious or...
I never thought
inhibited
about that.
Person.
After all those years of therapy, I never thought about that. But I will say that I was a very scaredy kid. Mm-hmm. When I was little. I was afraid of a lot of things. And my cousins knew this, and so they, like my cousin Johnny would, I was about 7 and he was like, I don't know, 10, and he would say, come on, I want to show you something in the garage. They had this creepy old garage, and I'd say, no, you're going to lock me in there. And he'd say, I'm not going to come here. You got to come in here and look at this thing. I'd go into the garage and they'd shut the door and lock me in there. And they could do this. And they was always telling me there were copperheads in the brook when we were rock. They could do this because they knew that I freaked out easily. And I guess that was one of my mother's traits. She also did freak out easily. She was a worrier. And then I think as a teenager later, I became sort of a rebellious, defiant, you know, fast cars and drinking and all that stuff. And I think that was on my part an attempt to lose that scaredy kid, to put that, not be that anymore.
Did it work?
Yeah, I think so.
Did you need to leave home to do that?
No, I did not have to leave home. I was very fortunate in that I fell in with a group of friends who my parents thought were really horrible people and didn't want me hanging around with. And as a matter of fact, this group of people There was a lot. There's been several deaths from heroin. There's been somebody became like a tramp and was run over by a railroad car. I'd have to say that the circle of friends of mine from high school, there's been a lot of tragedy and trouble. In my case, I always feel that those friends showed me another way of being, which is not be terrified all the time. It didn't work out well for some of them, but in my case, I did not perish with it. They also, in a strange way, introduced me to show business. That my friends were interested in. A lot of them were rock and roll musicians, and I had we had a band and a couple of different bands, and so they were very important in my growing up.
So I'm wondering if those friends who, you know, drove fast cars and did drugs and were much tougher than you were and kind of introduced you into a new kind of life, if you were able to model anything in The Sopranos on them, any characters on them or incidents or just a kind of way of living in the world, of not being afraid.
I never thought about this consciously, but as I'm speaking, of course, the conclusions are inescapable that the Soprano crew is a very tight bunch of guys who live life on the edge. My friends and I in New Jersey we were not in any way junior mafiosi or anything like that. We didn't gamble or play the numbers. I mean, there were people in the town who did that stuff, but we were in context. We were a group of kids in high school who later. Probably a year later, after the British invasion, became, I guess you'd say, the first hippies in that town. We crossed over the line from the James Dean thing into the Rolling Stones thing. That's just the time at which we lived. And so we were kind of involved with the Stones and the Beatles before most of the other kids in our town were. We gravitated to that right away. Kids at that time were saying, oh, look at those faggots with long hair. And we just immediately said, wow, that looks cool. Let's do that. We're always looking for, I don't know how you express it, just always looking for, I guess, a kind of an outlaw identity.
When you were growing up, were there movies that really scared the heck out of you, but you couldn't take your eyes off of them?
Oh, of course, yes. That's the kind of movies I always that's the kind of movies I always liked. As I said, I was a scaredy kid, and yet horror movies and scary movies to me were I could not get enough of them, and I think I found things to be terrified of in movies that other people didn't. I think a pretty big influence on me was this William Wellman movie, The Public Enemy, which I saw on Million Dollar Movie when I was probably 8 or 9, and they would play a movie all week long. And in it, there's the gangster Tom Powers is, you know, it's the one where Cagney's finally, after this life of crime. And actually, the mother is very important in that movie, too. He's got this sort of sweet little old Irish mother. But after this horrible life of crime and smashing the grapefruit into that woman's face and everything else that he did, he gets shot and he says, I ain't so tough, and he collapses on his knees. But at the end of the movie, he's in a hospital, and the rival gangs calls his mother's house and says, we're sending Tom home. And his brother runs up the stairs and says, Ma, they're bringing Tom home. And she puts on this I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles record, and it's playing, and she's making the bed, and she's sort of singing, and feathers are going every place. She's happy, and his brother's all excited he's coming home. And then there's a knock on the door, and the brother opens the door, and you see Cagney's wrapped up in a blanket with his head all in bandages from the hospital, tied up like a mummy, and he's dead, and he's dead eyes, and he just sort of topples toward camera, right into the lens. That's the end of the movie. This was the most frightening thing I'd ever seen. I was scared about this for a month. I could not get that out of my mind.
What was it that was so scary?
I don't know to this day. This, the idea, those people's expectations in the house, it's actually making me kind of sad. I don't know, their expectations of what was going to happen and what really did happen, that they were so happy that he was coming home and he was dead in such a horrible way, and how he'd wasted his life.
Well, David Chase, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been really great.
David Chase is the creator and executive producer of the HBO series The Sopranos. We'll have more on The Sopranos in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.